Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, in Vancouver, Canada. Here's Leela Chinia.
U.S. President Bush has introduced a flurry of new legislation rationalized by the war against terrorism. To explain and discuss this legislation, I'm joined now on the phone by Alexander Coburn, who's a political journalist and author. Good morning. Welcome to Red Eye, Alex.
Morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. Can you list for us some of the major new pieces of this domestic legislation?
Well, the major thing, the headlines would be, A, the ability to detain for long periods of time, point one, people who are non-citizens, which means that they can take people who are deemed suspicious and put them in, as has been happening, put people, for example, someone detained with an immigration violation, which might be the rationale, they put them in the federal center for detention in Brooklyn, New York. They put many people in the secure housing unit, which means they're in total isolation. They're permitted one phone call a week to try and contact a lawyer. If, when they finally get their chance at the end of the week to contact the lawyer, the number is busy, as of course many lawyers, particularly those who are public interest lawyers, they have to wait another week in solitary confinement before trying again. So effectively you have detention without charges for indefinite periods of time. Secondly, you have the whole realm of surveillance of the Internet, which the authorities have been wanting to do, and they tried to get through in 1996, which was the last big spout of anti-terror legislation, the Counterterrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of Clinton. And the Justice Department had a wish list at that time of which powers to surveil the Internet through various search engines were put forward and beaten back. Well, now, of course, they've rolled right through. Thirdly, you've got the ability to follow people, not get a warrant to listen in on a particular phone number, to allow a warrant to listen to the phone conversations of a person wherever they might be, which effectively allows you to throw, as you can imagine, a huge eavesdropping net. If you say a person is going from A to B to C to D, you can tap phones at A, B, C, or D, which is very serious. So the headline would be that the for many years now, the Fourth Amendment, which stipulates that you have protections against unreasonable searches and seizures, has been under increasing onslaught, particularly through the drug war, and the emergency legislation has made that situation much worse. The Sixth Amendment, ensuring the right to a speedy trial, is a dead letter so far, particularly as non-citizens are concerned. Added to which, of course, you have, at the moment, the military courts. You have the whole extension of military authority. In America, there is a thing known as the Posse Comitatus Act, which from the last century, which prevents the military from partaking in law enforcement within the United States. That already had been under considerable attack, but had held up by and large. Well, now that you've got the increasing militarization, or the prospect of increasing militarization of domestic security, you've got another very considerable threat there. And of course, you have the military tribunals, and you have these various new emergency laws. Some of the laws have the so-called sunset provision that at the end of 2 years, unless Congress reaffirms them, they will no longer apply after two years. But that by no means applies to some of the more egregious breaches of civil liberties.
Now, do we have any indications already about what sort of enforcement of these laws will actually look like in practice?
Well, you certainly have it so far as suspects or people who might be deemed suspicious in the wake of September 11th. You've had over 1,000 people at various times detained without charges, put in the conditions which I described earlier in the secure housing unit, in isolation, you've had people, of course, you have a tremendous amount of, you know, people phoning in suspicious, you know, there'd been, I think, 450,000 tips to the FBI from people saying X is suspicious, and, you know, there is a suspicious-looking Middle Easterner in the next room to me in the motel. And very often, on very, very slender pointers, you know, these people have been picked up, they've been held incommunicado, they can't get a lawyer, very often the people can't find out where they are. So, yes, there have already been very vivid examples of what could happen.
Now, how would you characterize the range of discussion of these new laws in the media and amongst academics?
Very interesting, actually, that in the wake of September 15, now the first the proposals from the Justice Department came down on about the 20th of September. Attorney General Ashcroft wanted by way of new legislation. At that time, the papers did a modest job in outlining the provisions, the major ones, of saying what was likely. But discussion was pretty muted. And in fact, about 3 weeks ago, all attention swiveled to the question of torture. There was a story in the Washington Post by Walter Pincus basically saying that the FBI were saying they wished they could torture people who weren't otherwise talking. These were applying to the original suspects picked up in the wake of September 11th. At which point, this was taken up. Many liberal columnists wrote saying that they thought torture wasn't a bad idea. That was a most disgusting public debate for a whole number of reasons. Most it seemed to center on whether torture was work or not, not whether torture was profoundly immoral and deeply destructive to the values of a society. The basic drift was that the Israelis did torture, and they called it moderate physical pressure. Anyone who's read the history of what happened to Palestinians will know that's a fairly ludicrous description. And there were questions of the FBI, could they use truth drugs, and so on and so forth. It's rather mysterious to me as to why the FBI floated this idea, unless they wanted just to gauge public reaction. They're probably rather heartened by what they listened to, and maybe, for all I know, I have heard a couple of rumors that in some cases they might be applying, some form of truth drug, although I can't say that with any certainty. That then took up the next 3 weeks. Now, when the terrorism bill became law and was signed into law by George Bush, now public discussion has been ratcheted up. And for example, Time magazine had a big story, the war on civil liberties. Various newspapers are now saying that many of the provisions of the anti-terrorism laws, the so-called USA Patriot Act, are very, very injurious to civil liberty. But the real debate, as so often happened, took place after it could have had any effect.
Now, you were mentioning the FBI is looking for the legalization of torture. How serious a danger is that, really?
Well, let's have a little perspective here. Until about 1930, torture was widespread in U.S. prisons. It was known as the third degree. There was a famous report called the Wickersham Report in 1931, which said that the extraction of confessions by violence was standard police procedure. This included rubber hoses, pouring water in people's noses when they were held upside down. I mean, we're talking very violent stuff. The Wickersham Report, actually it was appointed by Hoover, rendered that illegal, and the Supreme Court actually ratified the illegalization of torture as a systematic police procedure. The police then turned increasingly to the use of jailhouse snitches to get confessions or bogus confessions of guilt by people they suspected. There was, of course, and continued to be informal torture of a fairly widespread degree. I mean, conditions in U.S. prisons, by definition, amount to torture in many ways. First of all, there's the near certainty for young people of being raped, male inmates of being raped, staggeringly high rates of rape. And you have these conditions in secure housing units where you're put in a small concrete box for years on end, allowed 1 hour out of the box a day. That's many, many state prisons have these. And the UN and Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have actually issued a number of reports in recent years accusing the U.S. and the prison authorities of condoning torture. Added to which, overseas, there's numerous documentation of CIA participation in or sending of training, you know, hiring of people like Klaus Barbie in the post-war period who were, you know, known for their their interrogation methods. So the background is, if you want, fairly rich in U.S. knowledge and condoning of torture. However, it has to be said that the FBI, to my knowledge, has actually, its modes of interrogation were always deemed to be fairly respectable. Now, as I said just now, the fact that the FBI floated the story that if only they could do a bit of torture, one official was quoted by this guy Pincus, who's a very well-known national security journalist, was a fairly sinister indication either that they wanted to test the water or that someone was trying to head off the condoning of torture. And it is possible that, in fact, I mean, I told you there's been one informal second-hand story that, you know, they might be using some kind of truth drug in interrogations, but I couldn't possibly say that's a confirmed story. So what was disheartening to me was, instead of there being a major uproar in the liberal press, actually a guy like Jonathan Alter in Newsweek had a very complacent column saying that he favored certain methods of, you know, use of truth drugs, which sounds very comfortable, of course, you know, a little like taking an aspirin, whereas, of course, it's absolutely horrifying if you read the history of truth drugs, or saying that they should subcontract out, like, you know, like you have sneakers made of, in third world countries, we'd send people who need to be tortured to other countries where they're really good at and let them be tortured there. Not a very elevated moral debate, if you want to know the truth.
Well, I mean, as you're saying, I mean, in practice, the torture has been happening in prisons, and the attacks against people of color, red, you know, non-citizens, has been happening.
You mentioned that. Of course, Abner Luima, just to take one example, had a broom handle shoved up his rectum by a policeman in New York. I mean, there's a recent example, a widely known example of torture in a police station.
Exactly. And so how is this new legislation even more of a, how is this going to impact people? How is it more of a threat?
No, get this straight. There's no legislation on torture. This was, I was saying, when you asked me what sort of a debate had there been in public on the U.S. Patriot Bill, which contains nothing about torture, I was saying at the precise moment when there could have been a big press uproar about the provisions of the bill, the conversation was somewhat sidetracked, the public conversation, into this issue of torture. At that time, there was not that much commotion about what they were putting through in the Congress. But I hope I haven't misunderstood to say that there are laws allowing torture in the U.S. They're not.
No, I think you've been very clear. I think what I'm trying to get across is that in practice, a lot of this kind of stuff, like these attacks against people of color, the increased criminalization of dissent has already been happening. And what kind of impact is this kind of it being on the books going to have on people?
Well, you know, let's look at the world. It's already before September 11th. Which, you know, was, of course, a huge and horrible disaster, and inevitable. You know, any society of this nature, anyone reading the history of emergency laws, you know, in the United States going right back to the Sedition Acts of John Adams, anything like a major attack, Pearl Harbor, the rest of it, will... Actually, if anyone is interested, you were going to mention the website for our newsletter, Counterpunch.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, a speech by Senator Feingold on our website, www.counterpunch.org. Feingold was the sole vote in the U.S. Senate against the USA Patriot Bill. And he gave a remarkable speech, which is actually on our website, in which he went through, you know, the various waves of emergency legislation, you know, whether it was the assassination of Lincoln or the First World War or the counter-labor riots and the Palmer Raids of the 1919-1920, the Second World War, where not just Japanese-Americans, 100,000 of them, but also German-Americans and Italian-Americans were put behind barbed wire. Then, of course, you had the McCarthyite period and the attacks on the anti-war demonstrations of the 60s. So, you know, there's been wave after wave. And again, you want to think historically that, for example, the penetration of civil life in America by army security. Martin Luther King, if you look back on the history of surveillance of the King family, which were a radical family, U.S. Army intelligence had Martin Luther King's father under surveillance as long ago as 1916. So, you know, the army surveillance is nothing new in the United States. Now, you ask what will happen. Already in the wake of Seattle and the WTO demonstrations, you had a ratcheting up of very heavy police tactics. Anyone any of your audience there who might have gone down to any of the WTO demonstrations would have, or of course you had your own there in Ottawa, would have noticed that by the time, for example, it got to Los Angeles and the Democratic Convention, you know, this city was effectively not militarized, but under, basically in a state of siege by the LA police. The police in the Washington demonstration had orders to shoot to kill if necessary. So, you know, it doesn't take much to jolt the security state into heavy-duty posture.
Now, just turning to the international sphere, Bush has introduced new laws to undercut the formation and operation of an international criminal court. Can you tell us what he has in mind?
Oh, you mean with the military tribunals?
Mm.
Yes, well, the military tribunals are effectively hanging courts run under... There's a wonderful journalist here who once said, military justice is to justice as military music is to music. And Robert Sherrill, actually, a great journalist. The point of a military tribunal is, you know, the rules of evidence are totally different. There's no jury. It's a hanging court, effectively. There was a military tribunal when the Germans landed saboteurs in the United States. I think there were about 10 of them in the Second World War. They were tried by a military tribunal, and all but two were hanged. So in its summary, and obviously there are huge advantages. You don't have to, presentation of evidence is totally different. You can put people away very fast. And, of course, the Bush administration has always been against a real international court. They like their kangaroo courts, such as trying Milosevic or tried the Rwanda people or tried, you know, the Yugoslavs in The Hague. That's not the International Court of Justice. And, of course, when the International Court of Justice found against the United States in the case of Nicaragua, the United States immediately, thumbed its nose at the decision. They don't like a truly independent court any more than they liked in their military intervention, you know, the possibility even of a pretty tame United Nations having any say in the matter at all.
Well, I mean, Washington uses the term rogue state. Would that term, in fact, suit the U.S. practices best of all?
Oh, sure. If a rogue state, if the definition of roguery is someone, you know, acting completely outside the bounds of international treaties and, you know, recognized international procedures, absolutely. I mean, you can say that international procedures would have said that in the case of extracting bin Laden as a suspect from Afghanistan would have required you to go through certain formal international procedures. The demand for extradition, you go to the UN and so on and so forth, none of which, of course, the Bush administration did.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Alexander Coburn in California, and he's a political commentator and author, also publisher of Counterpunch. And if you'd like to visit the website there, you can visit. It's at www.counterpunch.org. And you can also call a toll-free number to get subscriptions, and it's 1-800-840-3683.
You've been listening to a program produced by Red Eye, an alternative media collective which broadcasts every Saturday morning from 9 until noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, in Vancouver, Canada.